Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boomer Debate Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boomer Debate, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And indeed, we're back again for another show on Blog Talk Radio. It's Tuesday, October 12th, 2010, and we're broadcasting from the Boomer and the Babe Enterprises studio in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be getting to our guest in just a minute, but before we do that, I want to make sure that we always invite people to come to our website, www.boomerandthebabe.com, sign up for our free online magazine, Boomer and the Babe Journal, and take a little tour around and see what else we're involved in, all the way from our mini-books to our web, our ebooks and consulting and all the other things that we do, and it's all pretty much there on the website. And I'm Pete Peters.
And I'm Deborah Brown.
And we have a tremendous guest today. Her name is Eileen Ringler, Dr. Eileen Ringler. Eileen is a business and people's growth coach. She's been doing that for 30-plus years. She does seminars, consults. She is a teacher in the Kaplan MBA program and maybe a few other things that she's going to add to that list. And Eileen, thanks for being with us on the Boomer the Babe Show. We're really glad to have you back with us again. You were on our radio show before.
Well, I'm so excited to be here, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you and hopefully reach all of your listeners.
Well, I think we're going to do just that, and we're looking forward to this conversation. I remember when you were on the terrestrial radio show on a local radio station here in Phoenix that we had a very nice visit with you, and we're looking forward to doing it again. I'm glad we could reconnect. Deborah, have you got anything that you want to ask Eileen? She knows the drill.
Yes, I would like to ask for your two-minute movie, and again, that is Your Life, as far back as you'd like to go, and coming forward to today, having our conversation. So give us your two-minute movie. Ready, set, go.
Great. Thank you. I was born Eileen Michelle Zimmel in the borough that has a book named after it called The Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Spent a good piece of my life there in a community of people who we still keep in contact with, lo these many years later. And that was probably the beginning of my real foundation of understanding why values are so critical to success in life and how making sure you satisfy your values are also going to make sure that you're successful in life. As I grew, went to college, as many people do, went to graduate school after I moved to Boston, the home of our Tea Party, and over the course of years, gained quite a bit of experience in both the corporate world and the private practice world in understanding what motivates people to grow, to be happy, and to be successful. And again, that's based upon the understanding of what your personal values are, and then how can you use those to completely integrate your life around them and find satisfaction with them. About 5 years ago, I was really, really getting very sick of the snow and decided it was time to not be where one had to shovel anymore. So my husband and I decided to relocate to Phoenix, where we currently live today, and I completed my doctorate in organizational leadership from UPhoenix Online and started my own consulting practice, Eileen Ringler Associates. So if you'd like to visit my website, I'm eileenringler.com, eileenringler.com. And in my doctoral work, again, I focused on why people make decisions using values and studied the Valley Leadership Program here, which is a community leadership program, to help them understand why people would choose to participate in a program like this so that they could recruit better and fill the pipeline better with folks who wanted to perform community service, always something that's needed and growing in need around the world, and have focused my practice and all of the work that I do to support my clients on understanding what your core passions are and figuring out how to use them to make yourself more personally satisfied, how to make your business grow more productively and more effectively, and overall, how to be a better, happier person in the world.
You've mentioned the word values many times, obviously. That's where you're pretty much your stock in trade.
Right.
But what is a value? Just why don't we start to the down at the base of the whole operation there. What is a value, or what are values?
Values are ideas or principles that you hold dear, that are very important to you, and that if you don't find activities or ways to find satisfaction with what you think is important in your life or those values, you're not a happy person. So I'll give you a really quick example, because as I talk to my clients, I find this works really well, is if you look throughout the course of your daily activities, the things that you do, the people you meet with, and you think about the things that really jazz you, or the things that make you very excited, and the things that you look to do more of, those are activities that fulfill those values or the things you think are really important to you. A personal example, in my world, I do my consulting. I also teach, and I do workshops for people in one-on-one coaching. Some of my real critical values are the things that I think are the most important to me are knowledge and creativity and wisdom. So as I do my work, I'm learning about people. I'm passing information along to them, and then they're passing information back to me. And I'm being creative in the way that I solve problems with them. So the work that I do, which I'm very happy at doing, pretty much helps me find satisfaction with the things that are core to me. So values are not good, they're not bad, they're just things that are personally important to you. And every decision that you make, whether you realize it or not, is based upon the need to satisfy some set of core values in your life. So in the work that I do with my clients, I help them identify those things and then move forward to finding more ways to satisfy those values in their life.
Do you find, Eileen, for those of us that are self-employed, do you find that our personal core values are often reflected in our business or work values, or are they distinctly separate? How do they interact?
Well, your values are your values. The things that you think are important are going to be with you regardless of whether you're applying them in a work setting or a personal setting. So there are times when you will be finding a greater degree of satisfaction with a value in a work setting more than in a personal setting, and vice versa. So to give you an example, if creativity is something that's very important to me, but yet in my work life, my job doesn't necessarily allow for a lot of creativity, I can go do painting lessons, or I could do photography lessons, or I could do dance, or some other way to find satisfaction with my desire to be creative. So there are folks out there who believe that you have a work set of values and a home set of values, but in my work with clients and the research that I've done, they're one set. You just find ways to be satisfied with them or gain more happiness in what you're doing in different ways in your life. So they are one set. You just work with them differently in whatever your individual circumstances are.
Deborah?
I was going to say something earlier when you were talking about the motivation to be happy, and that when we integrate our passions and our values and everything into what we're doing, that's integration, right? So what is the opposite of that?
The opposite of that is when you try to focus on things that someone else tells you are important, or society tells you is important, or you look at business models or personal growth models that really aren't in alignment with what your own goals are, if you've defined those goals, and you kind of implement things piecemeal or aren't happy with the results of them, so you don't feel fulfilled.
So it could be like you're saying, almost like a fractured mirror kind of look, you know, like a crackle landscape instead of something that's a nice smooth picture.
Right.
And I'm sure that you – go ahead.
What I find in my work with folks is that people tend to focus on things that someone else tells them they should value as important. So they try to work with those things, and they're unhappy.
Right. Now, I'm going to posit that the second half of life, you know, after you hit 50, 55 or whatever, is probably the perfect time to capture a lifestyle that really integrates all of your principles that you hold dear. Does that sound like something that you're finding with people as they get older? They can, you know, tap into some things that actually let them live the full life that they maybe couldn't in their previous, like in their work or whatever.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what's interesting is that I find that the folks in the boomer age category, of which I am smack dab in the middle, tended not to focus on this area as much because they were just trying to plow through. We're a very goal-oriented generation. And
right.
When I work with folks in the boomer age group, it's kind of tough to get them to release the hard goal orientation into more exploration of what I should be doing for myself. I do not find that same thing with the Gen Yers and the millennials because they focus on satisfying themselves and their values, which sometimes might cause a little bit of an abruptness in the workplace that employers who may be more our age don't necessarily always understand, but they're there. I want to be happy. I want to make sure that I do what makes me happy, and it makes them a healthier group. But in the boomer age group, it's a little bit of a leap for us to sit back and say, okay, what is it that's really critical to me at this stage in my life? And then how can I just go after it?
Well,
Go ahead, Pete.
I was just going to suggest that the younger age groups are, I don't want to use the word self-centered, but they're putting themselves really first, aren't they? In many respects, Eileen, they've gotten to be known as this is what I expect from my employer. If my employer doesn't provide A, B, C, and D for me, I will go and find another employer that will. And it's my belief, and this is a little off the subject, but it's my belief that they've seen what's happened to their parents, us, where the employers had no loyalty and the employers' values were always bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. That's what we got fed was bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. And they're saying that doesn't work with us.
And you know, I could not have led you to a better place in this discussion because, you know, we work with employers in order to provide them service for which they pay us. I mean, basically, that's what it is. It's a service contract. You know, we work, they pay. And the superior performers in life, the people who companies really want to attract and retain as talent, are those people who work to satisfy the things that they have talents in or strengths in. And employers need to be savvy enough to be able to say, okay, if I want to retain this top talent, then I have to be able to figure out how to give them work in a way that's satisfying to them, how to provide them rewards and recognition in a way that's satisfying to them, and they will give me everything they've got without fear. And in our generation, we oftentimes were more fear-driven rather than, I'm going to work for this employer, they're going to pay me, we're going to form this service contract, and we're going to work like heck for as long as we work together to be the best that we can be. If you look at, you know, performance appraisal systems in most companies, they're based solely on the things, or mostly on the things, that people don't do well. And the things that you don't do well are the things that really are activities that don't satisfy you, or things that even if you did them well, you'd be unhappy doing them and therefore wouldn't do them for long periods of time. But if you look at some of the literature that's out there, Jim Collins, Good to Great, all of the great companies focus on finding out where people's strengths are, otherwise known as their talents. And those, the talents are the things that the activities that you do which fulfill your values. And the companies then focus on those things, regardless of age, and find ways to give you work that will make you satisfied and happy, in which case you will want more work and you will do more work and you'll be more productive. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Well, that's striving to get to that win-win is something that I think is newer, shall we say, in the corporate world than it was in the past, because that win-win didn't matter in the past. It was just a one-way operation. And then all of a sudden, in my opinion, here again, I'm just voicing my opinion here, but the corporate structure decided that I'm not gonna let this guy hang around for another 6 months or a year. I'm gonna cut and run here now, because all of a sudden, after another 6 months or a year, he's vested. Now I got to match everything and retirements and so on. And that's just not something that that they wanted to do. And I think we're having some of those same issues right now as pertains to the way or the lack of growth that's going on, because I think that companies are still in this day and age getting all the work they can out of everybody, being very, very productive, higher production on a per capita employee basis, and making a lot of money, but they're certainly not going out to employ any other people. I think that's still going on.
Deborah, what are your thoughts?
I actually was going to say the same thing, in maybe not those exact terms, but we know that that employers are trying to get the highest level of productivity, and that many people have said, the studies are showing that this is the highest productivity level of, you know, recent memory right now in these companies. And I'm just wondering if there's something between, you know, doing these analyses that say, okay, I'm going to give you this, this, and this that satisfies your core principles and your core values, you're going to be happier and productive. But the problem is, like Pete's saying, then they get very productive people and they don't hire anybody else to fill in what should have been maybe the work of two people is now being done by one or one and a half. So I don't know. I guess it sounds like Pete and I might be a little bit more cynical. I haven't had an employer since 1991, and I think for him it's been 30 years. So, you know, we may be, you know, out of just what we think is happening, and you would be speaking from, you know, your studies and what you've watched in the companies that you work with. So, what do you think?
Well, you know, the role of leadership in a company versus the role of management in a company is to be able to fashion a work environment and culture where everybody is able to work in the best possible way using their talents. And then issues like productivity become a non-issue because you're so happy at what you're doing that you're just being productive because that's what you really, really want to do. So there, the world of work is changing from when we were all last working in the corporate world, primarily due, I think, to the World Wide Web and the global economy. So I might be working in, you know, my bunny slippers in Phoenix, but be part of a team in Kathmandu and
right,
Australia and other places. And that's the way I like to work. And because my work is not being judged by how much face time I have with everybody else there, it's what my outputs are and it's the way that I choose to work, I will be productive and I will be happy. And if you look at the companies that are not struggling through the recession as badly as they could be, you will probably see a trend of those companies focusing on managing the satisfaction of their talent. And
so
even today, yeah.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs How does that fit into this conversation? You know, you've got your shelter and your food, and obviously the company is going to pay a good salary for a good day's work and great, you know, productivity and you know, meeting quotas and all that stuff that goes with your productivity conversation. But that piece that maybe sits on top, which is satisfaction, what you're saying is if the leader in this organization can create a layer, an actual layer of satisfaction over the entire operation, I can see how that would be a fantastic win-win there.
Absolutely. But it takes a smart leader to do that, somebody who's confident and somebody who whose values are being fulfilled for them. So, you know, you have to be able to look at the leadership of the company and say, okay, how are they working to make people happy? Do they have to see them? Can they just trust them? How do they communicate with them? You know, I have a real good example. A couple of years ago, I was on a mentor board for a local women's mentoring program. And we had another person on the board who happened to be, at the time, one of the chief scientists for Motorola. And she had a really big commitment. She managed teams all around the world for new product development. And she had a real in-depth, heartfelt commitment to the balance of work-family life. She felt it was really important that she didn't work 24/7, and she felt it was really important that her team members got that same respect. But she had held meetings with people all over the world, and she had to make sure the work got done. So somebody in the room asked her how she did it. And what she said was she would have her meeting at 8 a.m., and one person from that meeting would stay on after it was over and become the chair of the meeting in the next time zone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the last meeting was in some diametrically opposed time zone to ours, and one person got to stay after that meeting was over and be the chair for her 8 o'clock meeting so that everybody could go home and be with their families.
Wow.
And that, you know, that wasn't a rocket science thing. But think about what a powerful message that sends, that I am the leader of this organization. You all report to me, hundreds of people, but I'm committed to making sure that you have a family, work-life family balance. So therefore, it's only one person would have to stay an extra hour, so maybe the meeting was from 4 to 5 in the afternoon or whatever, so that they didn't have to meet at 2 a.m. to meet the needs of her who was in the Phoenix time zone. I mean, what kind of a statement do you think that makes to employees?
That's fantastic. So she just had a rolling meeting that she started and then empowered the next person to be the chair of the meeting throughout until, oh, wow, what a great concept.
I know.
Fantastic.
You know, how simple is that?
Right.
Well, I think, Eileen, that a lot of these solutions really are, I don't want to oversimplify by saying simple, but a lot of them really are not complicated. Let's put it that way. It takes some thought. It takes some realization. It takes some probably some inward thinking and some creative thinking. I hate the term outside the box, but that's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And if people were to do that more often than not, I think a lot of stuff could really be much, much better in almost any area you could choose.
Yeah. And, you know, most people in the world that I have interacted with, which is probably a very, very tiny portion, want to be happy with their lives. They don't want to come home at the end of the day and, you know, crack open a beverage of their choice just out of frustration, but more out of celebration. So, you know, when I have counseled folks who need to change careers or, you know, have a lot of layoffs that need to go to other companies, we go through a process of what is it that's going to make you happy? And then how do you identify a place that will offer you those things. And it's not the same for everybody. I've talked with people who like a lot of structure in their lives. They need to be satisfied with the amount of process and structure so that the risk is reduced, which is perfectly valid because that's what they like. Well, then you don't go to a company that is willy-nilly in its decision-making, and you can't really tell how they do their work, which is okay, but you have to know what's going to make you happy. Very, very in-depth process for yourself, and then go find the place that will fulfill that for you. And it's not rocket science. It's actually very simple. It's just that most people just kind of go as opposed to doing the work that might be needed beforehand to know where to go. Now, in terms of the boomers, as Deborah asked before, once we get started doing this values work, I can't stop them because they just get so psyched. They get the bit between their teeth, and off they go because they want to be happy.
Well, that goes to something that Deborah and I have been saying about the boomer generation for years ourselves now, and that in the 60s, the boomers were searching, and they tried to it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it was let's smoke this and let's ingest that and let's see if we can find the great panacea, and then many of them turned to standard religion, and many of them turned to religious or philosophical beliefs outside the normal stream of normal religion, and the baby boomers are still, once you key them up like that, they're still going to be searching, and they're going to go after it, after it, and after it. I think that's the nature of our generation.
And there's nothing wrong with that. We moved the earth forward more so than almost any other generation prior to ours in a briefer period of time, which left many of us pretty tired, actually.
That's true.
Well, let's take a breath. But exploration is a really good thing.
It is. Do you think that values change throughout your life? Are you pretty much born with a set of values, or how does that work out?
Well, citing both research and personal experience for myself and with my clients, there are certain values. The research is all divided on this, which research always is, but there are certain things that you will probably never ever find enough satisfaction within your life, and then there's other things that you'll have enough, and then continue to search for things that really will make you happy, because sometimes your needs change through life. So let me give you a good personal example. Throughout my life, there has never been a time when I have been happy with how much knowledge I have. And I will probably never be happy with how much knowledge I have. I mean, the thing that when the web launched, I said, oh, my God, I'll be lost forever in all the stuff that's out there. So, for me, knowledge or how satisfied I am with how much of it I have in my life will never change, because there's always more to learn. And hence, the consulting work that I do and the fact that I teach and the fact that I go to school is more ways for me to continue to learn. When I was younger and less certain about my own economic security, wealth was really big for me because I needed cigarette and beer money, which, was important. I needed to, eat, not eat chunk light tuna, but eat white tuna, that kind of thing. So over the course of years, the acquisition of wealth or economic security is not as important to me because I'm satisfied with how much of that I have in my life. And they're not coming to take my house away tomorrow or even the next day because I've planned for that. So I can search for some other things. So it's kind of a balance. There are certain things that will remain forever, but there are certain things that you'll say, okay, I'm satisfied with enough of that. Now that I've grown a little bit, let me also be looking at what things I can really gain more satisfaction with my life around. Did that answer your question?
It does. And when you said earlier that knowledge, creativity, and wisdom were the three that are your values that are most important to you, I wrote those down, and I remember talking to you the last time we had this conversation, and I remembered that those are my three also. And I am a lifelong learner. I absolutely intend to know everything about everything possible. Pete says you do not need to know one more thing, you know?
Yes, you do. You do.
But that's not how it works. And
no.
I love doing things that are creative. I just sometimes I get so wrapped up in something that time just goes by, and I think, oh, my word, I've been messing with this little, tweaking this little logo I'm working on or whatever for 2 hours, and it's not even something that's ever going to be published. It's just because I was playing with it, you know?
Right, right.
And so passing along the wisdom, that's why we do this show. That's why we capture people's content and put it out in the various formats that we do. So, I mean, to be able to live the rest of my life doing the knowledge, creativity, and wisdom in a nice little package is perfect for me, and it's perfect for you. So isn't that interesting that we like each other so much?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you tend to find people, for the most part, who share similar values, even though it might not look that way on the surface. You know, in the example that we were talking about before we came on the air about this group of people who I used to work with, who I no longer work with anymore, and none of us work for the same company, if you put us into a room together, you would never think that we'd last for more than 5 minutes because we act differently, we talk differently. On the surface, it looks like we, you know, we would never get along. But yet, for the past now 13 years, we've traveled together, we talk together, we meet. And we just think with all the best things since sliced bread. So you tend to look towards folks who share the same value base that you do because you find happiness with them, even though they, in their outward behaviors, they might exhibit those things a little bit differently. My husband is a very creative guy in a whole bunch of different ways than I ever was. So the way that he exhibits his creativity is more in technical kinds of ways of fixing things and designing things where I would go in a different direction than he does. But the two of us together make an incredible team because he looks at creativity a little bit differently than I do.
All right.
So, Eileen, do you find that as you're talking with the people, clients, that they or maybe you don't even research this at all, I don't know. Do you find that they exhibit the same values as their parents or their siblings? Or have people developed their own value structure along the way? How much of a value structure is determined by the way you were brought up, who raised you, and what their structure was?
And that is a great question. It goes to the whole nature versus nurture thing. And there's no doubt that a lot of what you do in life is based upon the foundations of what you learned as a child or the culture in which you lived. If you are an unquestioning kind of person, then you take all of that and move forward and never say, is this right for me? But if you're a self-aware person, which I find most boomers are in my acquaintance, we're constantly asking, am I making decisions based upon my own values or the ones that were handed to me that I accepted without question? So, you know, every time I make some kind of decision, even personally, I can hear the echo of my mother in the back of my head, and I'm wondering if I'm making my own and or if I'm using the tools that they gave me in the most appropriate way. And I'll give you a real good example of that. My parents were both very wise people. My mother is still alive. And probably by the age of 11, they said to me, you know, we have given you all of the tools that we think you're probably going to need to make good decisions for the rest of your life from a values and culture perspective. We've talked to you about what's important, but we believe that you're an independent individual and have the brains to use this stuff to make yourself happy in life, but we're always here to support you. And that's a cultural thing that I have taken with me throughout my entire life because I thought that was important and relevant to me. And they did give me the tools. I was smart enough to use them for the most part. So that is the nurture piece that I actively use every single day in my life. Whether or not we're born with some of that stuff could be. We don't know exactly how hardwired we all are. The point is to look critically at what makes you happy in life and then marry that up with what your assumptions are. So sometimes when I do work with clients, I find that they think they should have certain things as values, and they don't really, and it upsets them. So sometimes women think that having a family and children and really finding their fulfillment through that venue should be something that's critically important to them. But when they actually do the analysis, it's not, and they feel guilty. And then on the other side, sometimes there are men who have that and who, from a societal perspective, don't think they're supposed to, and they feel guilty. So it's really around self-awareness and looking at what's important to you and trying to separate out what is best for you versus what other people think should be best for you. Was that a long answer to a short question?
No, I think that pretty much is in the direction that I was heading. Because I think of my own situation, and like you, you can hear your mother in the back of your head sometimes, and I hear my dad, and I go, you know, but that's not me. I mean, he was an engineer. It was black or white. There is no gray. It doesn't kind of work. It either works or it doesn't. it's like a switch. It's either on or it's off. It's not a rheostatic switch. But in what I do, what Deborah and I do, there are varying degrees of all in, so to speak. I can go all in. I can do this much and call it all in, and somebody else will do 10 times as much and call it all in, and some people will do one-tenth of what we're doing and calling it all in. And it's right as long as they're doing it. And that's the point that I try to make to people. It's almost as if you say, do something, even if it's wrong, but make a move, you know, don't sit on it. And that would not be my father's culture. My father's culture would be study it, analyze it, plan it, do it well, and it will work because you have put down all the groundwork. And I go, no. And it's kind of interesting in that I can make anything fit anywhere physically. Just give me a 10-pound sledgehammer and watch me make it fit. My dad measured it and cut it and placed it, and it fit very, very nicely the first time, but I don't have the patience. Now, is that a values? It must be, because I don't care what it looks like. I know I can cover it up with paint.
Well, it's because things are different. Things that are important are different for you than they were for him. I mean, when he did all of that, he was probably really happy.
Oh, he's very happy when he was doing that stuff, absolutely.
And, you know, I probably similarly to you don't necessarily do that kind of work, but I absolutely, you know, if you take it down one level, his desire was to do a very high-quality thing, maybe differently than your high-quality thing, but if I am going to approach a project that I need to have a very high-quality output, I might go and find somebody like your dad, because
yes,
I can't work that way, but
yes,
I absolutely value, and so we share that desire to do something very well. He just does it differently than I do, so I'll go find him.
And that's why Deborah and I work well together, because I say, let's get it done. This is what I think has to be done. And she starts taking it apart and doing it over and over and over again until she gets it to where she wants it and her level of expertise and her level of happiness. And I go, it doesn't have to be that good. You know, it doesn't have to be that good, because now we are over-delivering way beyond belief. And there comes a point in my book where it's my value structure says that's good enough. For what they're paying, that's good enough. And it's still more than most people will deliver, but it doesn't have to go beyond that.
Yeah, that just makes me go nuts. That makes me go nuts. So what it is, it's meticulous and exacting versus slap and dash, you know. Now, I'm not saying Pete, and that's not us, but I'm just saying when you're talking about somebody like Pete's dad would put things together, you know, in a meticulous and exacting fashion, where – you know, Pete would be more inclined to slap and dash and then cover it with paint, is a very interesting dynamic. It really is.
But it can work.
And it was very interesting. I mean, I always, every time I have a conversation with somebody, you know, about what it was like and so on and so forth when my dad was alive or his father was alive or whatever, I say, you know, my dad added on to this home that we live in now, and if, God forbid, there was an earthquake here in Arizona or whatever else, the rest of the house would fall down, but what he built would still be standing. And that's the example I use. Now, if it were me, the whole damn thing would be flat to the ground. I mean, that's just...
Well, because the stability of that type is probably not something that's really interesting for you.
It's not. No. You're right. It's not.
So, you know, I admire people who are able to find happiness and satisfaction with things that aren't important to me. Doesn't necessarily make me want to be like them, but I admire their commitment. Because,
absolutely.
You know, they want to do this thing, and they're thrilled to pieces with it when it's done, and the thing that's important and what I find in the workplace sometimes or even when I'm talking with people is they tend to denigrate those things which are not of value to them.
That's right.
And that causes conflict, and it shouldn't.
It shouldn't cause conflict. You're absolutely right. And that's kind of where we started off on some of this conversation was with the difference in the generations. Age-wise, what they want versus what their generation older than them want versus the generation that we want, and then versus the generation of our parents and what our parents wanted and expected. I don't know. I can remember the times when I would say to my father, and I have said to my mother recently, I'm not him. That's just it. I don't do it that way. Doesn't make me wrong. Doesn't make him wrong. It's just it's not my choice to do it that way. And that is where I think a lot of the stuff comes in, a lot of the argument, if you will, not argument, that's not the right word, but a lot of the difference of opinion comes in because people are expecting or are imposing their value structure on somebody else when both of them are right, and they just have to find a way to come to the common ground.
Right. And, you know, a lot of what I hear from employers who are rooted in length of service and loyalty versus quality of service from employees have a quandary because they had to pay their dues to get where they are, and the expectation is that everybody has to pay their dues.
Right.
And the generations that are coming into the workforce now and having such an impact don't have that same system. Their system is not based upon length of service. It's based upon quality of service delivery according to what's going to make them happy. And that it's something that in order for employers to continue to draft top talent, they're going to have to understand how to work with that in their own company cultures, because otherwise people are going to leave and go to places where those things are satisfying for them. So, you know, I remember many years ago I worked for Fidelity Investments, which was a great company to work for, and I enjoyed every minute there. And the culture at the time was kind of a very face-based culture. And there was a move at that point to start doing virtual work, especially because commuting costs were getting high and winters in Boston were bad and all of that. And the chairman of the company threw his support behind this change from face-to-face to virtualness, which was a little bit of a cultural shock, but they, you know, the people at the company believed in it so intensely that they said, okay, cool. And I was one of the first people to try the virtual work, which was wonderful for me. But it took a while for others who worked with me to get the belief that I was actually doing the work, even though they couldn't see me. And over the course of time, well, virtual work's now standard, but it's building up the trust if that's not where you've been and what you've known. And it was a learning curve for me, too. But I was thrilled. So I went into the office a couple of days a week. I worked from home a couple of days a week. I was happy, and I was more productive.
You're working in your wheelhouse, so to speak.
Yeah. So it's learning how to adapt and be flexible from a corporation perspective and from an employee perspective, because sometimes there's potential for change, and if it's not there right this very second for you, you might also need to take a longer view to say, how can I, as an employee, work towards making this environment better for me? So sometimes it's a journey that companies and employees take together, but you have to have the buy-in to the core values of what the company stands for in order to make that journey successful for yourself.
Let me ask you this about looking for an organization that aligns with your core values. You're out looking for work. A lot of people are looking for work nowadays. A lot of people can't find it regardless of what they do, regardless of where they look. At this juncture, you're going to find a job, and if you're out of work, chances are you're going to take that job because you need to have the money. I mean, it's just that much a fact that you need to have the cash. But you could be working for somebody that is in direct competition with what your values are. And where does that leave you?
Well, you don't, you know, you go there because you need the money, no question. And, I mean, let's face economic realities. You want to satisfy all your values, but if they're going to come take away your house, there's certain decisions that you might need to make that are diametrically opposed to what's important to you. But you won't be a top performer there for very long because you'll hate the job, and eventually the job will hate you. So you need to be thoughtful about what you're leaping into, how long you think you're going to be there, and what, you know, and if you can make any kind of a choice or look for, here's an example. Say the only jobs that are available are dishing up burgers in a fast food restaurant. And there are many people who take those kinds of jobs because they have to, because they're coming to take away their house because they haven't paid their mortgage. But not every single burger joint has the same way of working with customers.
Gotcha.
Or believing what they should do in terms of cleanliness and how to work with people and attitude on the job. So if you, and you can find that stuff out fairly easily, even though people think it's tough, you can, you know, for certain jobs you can actually go observe. So say you're going to go into the Burger King or the McDonald's or the Wendy's or whatever, you could go onto the company's website and look at how they describe their company. There will be words that will jump out off the page and resonate with you either positively or not. You can look at what charitable organizations or philanthropic efforts they engage in, because there might be marriages there. You can Google them and see what's been written about them in the press. So it's not as difficult as one might think to go, and at least if you have to take a job in the interim that's going to get you the rent, at least be a little happier at it and maybe stay longer at it and work your way up the ladder, even though it might be a totally different career path than the one you chose before. And many people are facing that today.
Absolutely, absolutely. Deborah, do you have anything?
I was going to say something about fear. And I'm wondering if fear keeps people from accessing the happy life that they probably maybe just don't, I don't know, maybe they don't think they deserve it. Maybe they don't think they can get there from here. Is fear a barrier?
Absolutely. You know, the uncertainty, some people have higher degrees of uncertainty tolerance or, you know, fear rejection than others do. And it depends upon a whole bunch of factors in your life. You know, part of my ability to be confident about doing what I'm doing is based upon the fact that I feel some satisfaction with my financial security. So, you know, again, if they were coming to take my house away, I might be afraid to go be creative as much as I'd like to be creative now and in the future. But I will work towards that. And some of it is environmental. Some of it is cultural, what you grew up with. You know, how many people do you meet who say, well, I can't try this because, and it was some thing that they learned in their youth or cultural or religious aspect that told them, no, you can't do this. And that's, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And there's fear of success. There's fear of failure. There's fear of loss. There's fear of having. I mean, and whatever inner terrorist you have going on, or I call it the monkeys jumping on the couch in my mind, you know, sometimes, okay, monkeys, stop. You know, when you've got all that chatter and all that conversation in your brain doing that exact thing, you know, you're not good enough, you're not this, you're not that, you can't do this, you can't do that. You know, finally you just have to say, all monkeys, be quiet. I am perfectly fine and I will go and do whatever I want to because I want to be happy.
But that's hard. That's not easy. It's hard.
Very hard.
And, you know, that's why, you know, when I work with clients or I do workshops or even in my teaching, I encourage people to find support systems to help them out. You know, either a significant other or a support group or blogs. You know, blogs have sprung up like this radio show and stuff that's on the web where people can go reach out and find others who will help them or others who might reduce their fears. Or, you know, my husband had a very critical illness a couple of years ago, and I was just flummoxed and I was terrified. And I went out on the web and I found blogs of people who were experiencing the same kinds of fear feelings that I was. And I saw what they wrote. I interacted with them. It gave me the confidence to move forward with the things I needed to do to continue to make myself happy and to feel like I could have some impact on saving his life. So you can't do it yourself. Nobody can do it themselves.
Right. Right. So if you were going to give our audience some steps to take to increase their satisfaction, what would it be? What would they be?
Well, the first thing I would recommend is actually to find out what is important to you in a fairly formal fashion. Now, on my website, there is a values assessment instrument that, you know, you can download. It's public domain, and it'll give you just a first shot at figuring out what's important to you. And do it. Think about it, talk to others about it, put it in your back pocket, and see as you go through your daily life if what you thought was important when you marked it down on the list is really what's important to you. And then once you kind of have a good sense of what things you value very much, things that are very important to you, and my instrument isn't the only one. There's a million of them out there. This one isn't even mine. It's part of the John Bloomberg Hopkins School of Public Health. You could find them anywhere. Then sit down and say, okay, if my life were to really be blissful, nirvana, according to what my values are, what would it look like? What would I do? What would I say? Where would I work? How would I interact with people? And write it down. And then look at what you have today. Map the gap. And then make an action plan for yourself moving forward, knowing that it's not an overnight thing, but at least you have a plan of attack. That, right. And it sounds short. It's a great process. It's a lot of fun. Takes a little time.
Well, the discovery is important, and it's probably going to be things that you'll recognize, of course, because that's how it works. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's me. So you'll recognize yourself. But then probably the number two step when you're saying, if my life were at the max, you know, so that I was in nirvana, so happy I couldn't stand myself, and you realize, wow, I would not live here. I would not live with, you know, these circumstances. I would not have those clothes. I would not, you know, I would not wear these shoes. And then you think, okay, great. Now I am completely aware of what I don't want, but I also like a lot of the things that that I do have, and then go for the filling the gap. I think that's a fantastic process, but I would think it would take a lot of insight and sitting quietly with yourself and saying, okay, what am I going to do?
That's part of it, and part of it is actually talking to other people to be asking them, look, you know, we get on well together. We work well together. You're a great customer. You're a great client. You're a great friend. What do you think is important to me? Because if you live your values, which you do, others see that. Let them give you feedback. It's an incredible conversation to have with somebody else.
Right. And then there are those when you would ask them, what do you think moves me? What do you think my values are? They go, I just can't figure you out.
Well,
I'm serious when I say that. And what is that indicative of? What do you do then?
Well, what I do is I tell my clients, excuse me, to ask people, okay, let's try it a different way. Can you tell me about a time when we worked together or had a conversation together or did an activity together that was fun and great? What did we do? How did I act? What was my part? And just write that example down or put it somewhere in the back of your head and then go back to your values and say, okay, what was I doing that made me happy based upon the example that they just gave me? And in some cases, it might be outside of what you thought. Because, again, we all have assumptions on what we think we should value versus what our actions are. I never considered myself a highly competitive individual until I took up the game of golf, actually. But one day my husband said to me, my God, you're a really goal-driven individual. Very, very, you know, you're very competitive. I was shocked, absolutely shocked. So I went back and I looked at some of the work I had done, some of the decisions I had made, and, you know, they were from a more competitive nature, my need to feel like I was number one than I would have thought by myself.
So sometimes you learn more about yourself than you even thought was possible.
Correct. Through others, because they see you and they perceive you.
It relates somewhat to what Deborah and I do when we talk about your brand, what your brand is. And your brand is what other people say it is.
Yeah.
And there's a certain element of that as far as what people think of you and what they think your values are, because they're seeing it completely in an undetached way that is completely unrelated to what you're thinking about yourself, and they see different things.
Right.
So if you mention Eileen Ringler to somebody, they're going to say A, B, C, and D, and Eileen Ringler might be thinking D, E, and F. it's entirely possible. Your thought process is different.
Well, that's why the self-awareness constant, and there is actually quite a bit out there on the web in terms of articles and about brand and values. And if you Googled it, you'd find there's just a ton of it out there, because that is how the marketing gurus are telling people to differentiate their brand through the identification and application of their value structure into their marketing scheme.
Absolutely the case. That's what we're telling them. No doubt about it. Well, Eileen, we've come to a very rapid conclusion of an hour. I mean, it's been amazing, as it always is. I think were you on for an hour the last time we had you on the show? Or was it a half hour? I don't remember. I think it was a half hour. And boy, I tell you, we got that one went fast. And we used to call it the fastest half hour in radio, and now we're going to have to say this is the fastest hour in radio. And we didn't even have any commercial breaks in here. So that's really amazing when you stop and think of all that. But why don't you go ahead, if you don't mind, and give us all your contact information again so we make sure that we have it on the archive for when people listen to it in the future, and so you can get all your word out and all your info. People will know where to find your information.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. My company is Eileen Ringler Associates, and that's spelled Eileen Ringler. And my website is EileenRingler.com, and you can contact me through my website, or you can email me directly at Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at EileenRingler.com, phone 602-300-6465. I thank you so much for the opportunity to be on the show with you today.
I tell you, Eileen, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and pleasure to talk to you when we meet up at a chamber function where you were speaking. That was a lot of fun as well. And I recommend that anybody that's interested in discussing their values and finding out more about their values and how they can use the values to make them a better business and a better individual, they should be contacting you. There's no doubt about it. Thanks again for being with us today, Eileen. You've been listening to the Boomer and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you information and conversation with Eileen Ringler, the Queen of Values. I don't know if that's the title she'd like to be called, but we're going to call her the Queen of Values for the moment anyhow. You can listen to the Boomer and the Babe Show Monday through Friday here at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk Radio. That's Boomer and the Babe. Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe. Remember to go to our website, the email is host@boomerandthebabe.com, and go to the website, www.boomerandthebabe.com, see what we've got going on and everything else we do. Sign up for our free online magazine there. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. We'll see you at the next show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
To the Boomer and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.